Hey there. So, am I too loud? You can tell me. I have a loud New York neurotic voice, so if it gets to be too much at any point, just go, less of you, and I'll move back. Okay. So, I'm going to be giving a talk that will integrate a bunch of contemporary therapeutic modalities and integrating it with some early Buddhist principles and then some guided visualizations. The general theme will be addressing the underlying roots of compulsive behaviors, addictions, and so forth. And then we'll talk about ways to address these emotionally driven behaviors. And the point of the guided visualizations is both to integrate some really beautiful early Buddhist practices that are not really contemporary, in contemporary practice, integrated or used that often, and I think that they're very important. So that's about the size of it, and here we go. The ideas that I'm going to be drawing from a lot of different major clinical and psychologists and neuropsychologists, as well as some giants in the field of attachment. So, if you at the end have any questions about which authors, or if you'd like to delve into these ideas a little deeper on your own, I'd be happy to give you some places to start. But I don't know, that might be the last thing you want to think about after today. So our species evolved due to environmental pressures, natural selection, to be a social species. We spent the bulk of the 200,000 some odd years, roughly, that Homo sapiens have been around, living in small hunter-gatherer collectives, mutually reliant upon each other. The quality of our bonds with the other five or six people we'd spend our entire life with were of, you can't overemphasize how important it was that we maintain good relations with others. To it, if we were out hunting for or trying to gather sources of food on any given day, the chances are each one of us in our clan of five or six adults, four of us probably wouldn't come away with anything. Food was scarce on the savannas, and maybe only one would come back with any food. And if that person didn't share their what they collected, we could starve. Furthermore, if we were out together looking for supplies and a member of another clan encountered us, if our fellow didn't warn us, we could be killed. If we didn't have good relationships within our clan, if we were sick, we would die without being tended to. So our species developed major circuits, and especially in the right brain and down to the midbrain, anterior cingulate cortex, temporal lobes, etc., that guide how essentially the, create impulses to connect and to bond. And when we don't do it well, we experience a whole list of developmental failures as well as negative affects and so forth. So we're all born with this psychobiological system motivating us to connect and establish proximity so that we can not only flourish, but we also can regulate our emotions, our affects, our state of being over time. We're not born with any of these abilities. We are trained how to survive and what to expect of each other and how to go about regulating, auto-regulating, co-regulating our emotions and so forth. So the first few years of life, we are right hemispherically dominant. The left brain is actually very much subdominant, working in the background, slowly biding its time, learning some language and observing what kind of objects people focus their attention on. But the bulk of our life, our first 4 years of life, we are right hemispheric, which means the right brain, with all the neurons that are being connected and the synaptic bonds, are being forged in the first 3 years of life. And what they are doing is very simple. They are observing how we connect with the people around us, whether or not we are seen. Well, there's actually four qualities we need to experience in those first couple of years. We need to feel safe with the people that we're around. Safe doesn't only mean that they're not going to hurt us, but more so that they're not going to abandon us. They're not going to just suddenly disappear. That's the very first attachment need. The second is we need to feel seen, to be seen in the eye of the other. The caregiver is vitally important for our species. In fact, the first regions of the brain that work on our behalf and are wired, that are complex, the fusiform gyrus and parts of the somatosensory lobe, are what recognize other people's faces, their eyes, and allow us to process whether we are being seen by someone else. This is vitally important for the feeling of being secure. An infant that doesn't feel seen, its nervous system stays in sympathetic arousal because it feels continuously vulnerable. To the degree that an infant feels seen and the proximity of a caregiver, then its autonomic nervous system can return to what's called parasympathetic, which is your rest, digest. It's what allows you to bond. It's what allows you to develop exploratory behaviors and so forth. The third quality is the sense that we can be soothed or calmed when we are in distress. So we need the feeling that if we are suddenly scared, overwhelmed, if we experience physiological discomfort, any sudden spike in our state of arousal, our state of security, that there'll be some caregiver there that will create a sense that not only that they see us, they understand what we're experiencing, they're not going to go away, but through a gentle touch, through soothing words, through some kind of change in the environment that they author, that we will suddenly start to feel calmer, more relaxed. And once again, our nervous system switches back from the arousal fight-flight state to the the shutdown state to the relax and digest state. And the fourth and last quality is the feeling of being appreciated, delighted in. As children, we are constantly, hopefully, going through a series of developmental milestones where we acquire tools, acquire abilities, such as walking, playing with toys, building things, being able to move around on our own, being able to claim objects as transitional objects and all that. So The child needs to feel that with each acquisition of new skills that the caregiver sees and approves and delights in our achievement. So those are the four things we need. We need to feel safe, which means the people we rely on are available. They will not suddenly disappear. Seen, which means they can pay attention and get what emotional state we're in. Soothing, and when we are distressed, that they can calm us down. And delighted in or appreciated for all the efforts we put in to move forward in life. Safe, seen, soothed, and appreciated. Those are the four foundations of attachment. If we get those, we have a sense of what's called a secure base. That's an important term to know if you have any interest in attachment theory. A secure base is the sense that there's some place you can go, some people you can reach out to help you regulate your emotions. When you have a secure base, it means that you'll be able to continue outward in your life, taking risks, being vulnerable, embracing opportunities. If you do not feel there's a secure base, you will become risk averse. It will be very difficult to embrace challenges that require extending oneself, where you know we might fail. So the sense of a secure base is vital for human functioning. Some people call this, not that you need to know the term, but some people call it object constancy. Object constancy is the sense that the infant has a sense that even though the caregiver is not physically available at that moment, the child knows as an emotional reliance that if necessary, she can find her mother or father, that the parent will be available. And they, even more so than that, because there's been such a quality of care in early life, the child has a sense of what the parent would do to soothe or appreciate or give direction. So object constancy is a felt sense of, I am not alone in the world. It's not so much an intellectual story, it's a feeling, it's a somatic experience, it's a sense of confidence that we've introjected or internalized what our parents, how they would help us, or our caregivers. So if you have a secure base, then you wind up confident to explore the world. You are good at regulating your emotions. In relationships, you will not be preoccupied with your partner, but you will pay attention to them when it's important. You will have a good work-life balance. You will embrace opportunities. All of these behaviors are visible as early as 1 year of age, when children can, generally between 1 and 1.5, they can do the strange test where babies attachment styles can be determined. And the secure child, when the mother leaves or father leaves, the child cries for a little while, but it has object constancy, so it knows that parent will return. And so it can turn to the stranger in the room and interact, or it can go and play with the toys. So it has this deeply embodied right hemispheric sense of, I'm not alone, my mother is going to come back, so I can explore the world. I don't have to just become small or sit there. That's about 50% of the population in every clinical test, and there's been thousands upon thousands with literally now, I mean, I don't know how many millions of people have done the clinical tests. In childhood, it's the strange test. In adult life, it's the adult attachment interview, but I don't, like, literally every study shows that roughly half of the population is secure, and I don't get to meet any of them. I mean, I don't know whether The hell they are. I mean, I think, frankly, I'd be bored if I met somebody who was truly secure. I'd be like, you know, why are you coming to my classes? Why are you seeking? I don't know what to make of you. Certainly, I was not a product of that. But over the course of lots and lots of therapy and all that, I've managed to become what's called earned secure, which is quite a journey. What about the other half, the people that I meet and hang out with and work with and all that? Well, one of the most predominant attachment styles is anxious ambivalent. These are, in childhood, these are the children that don't really trust that their parents, their caregiver is always paying attention. So in the strange test, that child will follow around the mother, and when the mother leaves the room, the child will not only become hysterical, but will never be soothed, will never turn to the stranger in the room, the other adult, to develop a new connection, will never play with the toys, will just hover by the door waiting for the caregiver to return, and then when the caregiver does return, that baby still won't be soothed because she doesn't really trust that her mother is paying attention. Even before the mother leaves the room in the strange test, a lot of the anxious, ambivalent babies essentially already are anticipating what's going to happen because they develop a amazing skill very early, which is called hypervigilance. They learn how to read the micro expressions on people's faces and can see, oh, shit, excuse me, I know this is New York Inside, I'm not supposed to swear, that just came out. So used to Dharma Punks New York. The child goes, oh, fruck. I'm not going to have access to my caregiver. She's going to abandon me. So these children grow up to be individuals that very often form fantasy bonds. They become fixated on partners that are not available. They become preoccupied in relationship because ever since childhood, they haven't had a sense of trust that the attachment figure in their life will be reliable or stay with them. They tend to have and will grow up to have imposter syndrome very often and core shame. I'll talk about that later on in the afternoon. They are prone in relationships at times to be jealous. More importantly, their nervous system tends to focus on the tends to sway over to the sympathetic arousal because when you're hypervigilant, when you expect the important people of your life to not often be available or reliable, then you will be prone to chronic stress and anxiety disorders. And it's extreme. Anxious attachment can present as borderline personality disorder. And when it comes to relationships and important endeavors, people with anxious attachment tend to remain right hemispherically dominant. They don't integrate their left rational, cold, intellectual brain very often. When it comes to navigating through relationships, they're driven by affects, their core emotional experience. People who are secure balance both the left and right. They can integrate their emotional needs with their rational understanding of what is available, how to work through conflict and disappointment. They can use language very well, so they integrate left and right. On the other hand, there's what's called as dismissives. Dismissives or avoidance are the child that fundamentally very early on has given up on its parent for regulating its emotions. The parent is either constantly misattuned, which means not capable of paying attention, or the parent is constantly anxious or distracted or angry. Very often children who go through, whose parents go through a divorce, and the parent that winds up with custody, if that parent is struggling after the divorce, really deeply disappointed in the outcomes, stressed financially and so forth, the child doesn't ever develop that soothing connection with the caregiver, because the caregiver is always worried about external factors. And so the child grows up feeling engulfed by the parent's emotional state. And so that child grows up to seek distance, to minimize its needs from attachment figures. To the child grows up to be exceedingly left brain, minimizes its emotional needs from others, tends to be hyper-rational when talking with their partners about emotional material. They cannot integrate their feelings. In adult life, the person with a secure base can integrate and create an autobiography that where they understand how their past and early life influence their adult behaviors, and they can integrate the emotional events of their life into a coherent narrative. The anxious person, their story will have almost no left hemispheric listing of facts or chronology. It'll just be this scattered list of emotional events and disappointments, but it won't have a coherent narrative, and they won't be able to easily describe what caused their caregivers to have their distance or unreliability. The dismissive child will become exceedingly self-reliant. Little miniature adults, when they're still children, will struggle when they, in adult life, when it comes time to explain or have a narrative or an autobiography of their life, they will cut out, when they talk about themselves, all of the emotional events, and they'll just have this sort of very basic, my parents were fine, they kept a roof over my head and there was food on the table, what's your next question? There'll be no list of emotional events, there'll be no understanding of or willingness to investigate emotionally hot events from childhood. They will be rigid. They very often struggle to experience empathy, controlling behaviors, presenting as obsessive compulsive disorder very often, narcissistic personality disorder in the extreme. And they struggle making big decisions, because in order to make big decisions, the way you do it is by feeling your somatic markers, according to Damasio, a great neuropsychologist. What avoidants do is they shut down awareness of their bodies, their subcortical, so they don't feel literally what's going on in the emotional centers of their body, and therefore they cannot integrate their emotional intuition or gut feelings. And so they'll get stuck in arguing through the logic of any choice. But if you ever worked through the somatic marker theory, you know that in important decisions, we can't make a choice that way. Every big decision in your life, if you try to logic it out, you'll find good reasons not to do it and good reasons to do it. If you don't have any gut feeling of this is what I want to do that you trust, you'll be stuck, and it'll be difficult to take risks in your life. Lastly, I'm only going to give just a very brief overview. Well, I'll give a normal one, because actually it's important for today's topic. Those two groups are roughly 15 to 20%, and then 10% of the population is what's known as disorganized. Disorganized are children that were frightened of their caregiver. Their caregiver was literally created a sense of fear. So the child is stuck in an impossible situation. All of its evolutionarily installed psychobiological drive to connect with its own caregiver is encouraging it to go towards the caregiver, but the caregiver is frightening. So the other impulse is to get away. So they're stuck in this push-pull. The only answer in that situation is dissociation, collapse, the ancient parasympathetic dorsal dive where the child disconnects, hides. And this child in the strained situation will do really bizarre behaviors. When the parent leaves, they will be distressed. They'll hide under a table. The avoidant child, by the way, doesn't care when the parent leaves. Just goes, plays with toys, has no interest. When the parent returns, they're like, eh, feh. No interest in you. The disorganized child will hide. When the parent returns, the child will do bizarre behaviors like walk towards the parent, then stop and walk away, might walk backwards towards the parent, might, while it's hugging the parent, be pulling away. These are the classic disorganized patterns, and these grow up to be adults that struggle to fulfill themselves in any career. They are prone to regressive tendencies, self-harm. And if given today's topic in terms of compulsive behaviors and addictions, just looking at addiction, they've done longitudinal studies of attachment styles. You follow secure to adults, and you rarely see any form of addictive behavior. You follow longitudinally anxious and avoidant, and you start seeing addictions, substance abuse, and so forth. In avoidance, it's somewhere around 30 to 40% in the ACE studies, and anxious, it's just a little bit lower than that. But you follow disorganized, and what you find is addiction, self-harm. And so what this has shown over and over again in studies, longitudinal, is that addiction and compulsive behaviors are attachment issues. They are events that started early in life due to a struggle for an infant to develop what's called a secure base, a sense that they are safe, seen, soothed, and appreciated. Now you might say, well, I was a low bottom drunk for many years. I got sober and my childhood was fine. To which I would respond, in the longitudinal studies where they literally did home observations of children which had really, really damaged, insecure attachment structures. They followed them, you know, they met up with them 30 years later. And those individuals as adults would invariably claim, oh, my childhood was great. But there's empirical evidence that it wasn't, that the child was marked as, by observing and by the strange test, was not secure by any means. We have as adults, when there's been a lot of pain and early attachment disturbances and trauma, we have a vested interest in ourselves very often to block or not to integrate those wounds into our self-narrative. So it's very common for people to believe that everything was just great. The bad news, always going to give the bad news first so I can give you the good news. The bad news is the studies between the attachment style of the infant at 1, 1.5 to the adult attachment interview show about a 75 to 80% adhesion or stickiness. In other words, you stay in whatever attachment style you were as a baby your entire life. But for so that's the bad news. The good news is that roughly 20 to somewhere between 20 and 25, one out of every four people manage to change. The bad news is that a lot of people can go from secure to disorganized if they've had traumas in the years subsequent to their childhood. But the good news is that roughly 1 out of 10 actually can become earned secure. When I was a child and had essentially a variation of the adult attachment interview much later at around 6 with a child psychologist, I was found to be disorganized because my father was a violent alcoholic, used to beat up my mom in front of me. There was a lot of violence in the household. When I, later on, I, through years of therapy, Buddhist practice, I became earned secure and have been in a partnership with my ever-tolerant wife for 19 years. So, yeah, I guess I'm 1 out of 10 that managed to change towards from something that was disorganized with a great deal of substance abuse and alcoholism until I was 34. And now I have 25 years of recovery. So that's where I stand in it, to be fully disclosing. So does the Buddha have anything to say about this, or early Buddhism? Well, in fact, a very key figure in early Buddhism, Buddhaghosa, the author of the Visuddhimagga, based on his interpretation of the Abhidhamma, and this was thousands of years ago, Buddhaghosa pointed to the existence of 4 specific developmental types, one of which was healthy, the other 3 not healthy. So already we're suspiciously very close to this model. The healthy in Buddhaghosa's model were called sada, or confident. These are people who see good and wholesomeness in the world. They have confidence. They are they explore life. They are quick to offer help. And when they enter a room, Buddhaghosa uses this example of how people act when they are in novel situations. When this person enters a room, they tend to be open to whatever is present and will wait for people to come to them and talk. They will not push themselves. They expect, like secure people, they expect the best of others. The other 3 are based on the 3 kilesas, or poisons, in early Buddhism. There's lobha, the desirous. This is the person who goes into the room and immediately sees all the things that they want. They're hyper aroused. They're essentially on the go. And they, in his analogy, these are the people who will glom on to one specific person and follow them around. Very suspiciously, in my mind, maybe I'm reading in, but I find a direct correlation with anxious attachment, which are people that are fixated on acquiring safety and sticking to one person for security, preoccupied. The second are the aversive, dosa, and sometimes known Buddhaghosa's writings, he also calls them conceited. These are people who find fault. They go into a room, they immediately look at everything that's wrong. I don't like the, you know, I don't like, well, everything here is nice. I can't find anything. But, you know, I don't know, this lamp, whatever. You know, I don't like these lamps. They could have done better with the lamps, you know. They find what's wrong. They stay away. They try to become self-sufficient. And I see an extreme correlation there, or not extreme, but much enough of a correlation with avoidance, who are narcissistic. The jump between conceited and narcissistic is a very small leap to make. And then finally, the last group is what is called delusional, or moha. These are people, according to Buddhaghosa, that are overwhelmed, fearful, and escape into fantasy. And that, for me, is almost an identical definition with the disorganized dissociation, people who escape from the overwhelm of reality into an interior, depersonalized, derealized state where they have checked out. So I would argue that the observations that we find in early Buddhist texts have enough of a correlation that we don't have to view these understandings of the way people break down as entirely contemporary. So, most important, when we don't have a secure base, when we don't have people that a felt sense of object constancy, that there'll be someone there to help us process the feeling that we're not alone. When we don't have that, when we feel deeply alone in the world, whether because we're anxious and we're constantly chasing after love from unavailable people, or we've given up on intimacy because our early experiences were so underwhelming, or whether we've been literally frightened or abused in early life, and we tend to shut down when intimacy is possible. If we don't have a secure base, we will struggle to regulate our emotions when we are angry, frightened, sad, in distress, when we feel guilt or remorse, when we feel a sense of disgust, all of the sort of basic emotional states. Not only that, but the core affect states, when we are, the Buddha calls it Vedana, when we feel deeply uncomfortable in our bodies. Doesn't have necessarily a complete obvious emotional correlation, but there's a sense of discomfort. If we don't feel object constancy, if we don't have a secure base, if we haven't been able to develop mutually reliable relationships where we can get authentic and talk about whatever we're experiencing, we will feel the need to auto-regulate, not co-regulate our emotions. Auto-regulate means we do not reach out. We learn to try to soothe or develop a sense of appreciation or develop a sense of being seen through a behavior that doesn't rely on another human being. Again, human beings are meant to co-regulate. We are meant to reach out, to talk to each other. So we know from the work of Thomas Lewis, all the way through Alan Shore, all the way through Dan Siegel, when you feel a secure base in your life and you're in distress and you talk to another human being, what happens is the limbic structures co-regulate down and we go back from the sympathetic arousal, I'm not safe, to a sense of security, I'm okay, I can relax. If you don't believe there's somebody out there, you will attempt to regulate your emotions on your own. And this is where compulsive behaviors and addictions come in. Compulsive behaviors and addictions are attachments to dead objects. By dead objects, I mean they're not real human beings. They are behaviors or substances that are meant to essentially replace other people in the vital need to regulate our emotions. The person who comes home alone at night after a hard day of work and feels their loneliness might very well scour their kitchen and binge eat food. Why do they do that? Because in binge eating, they start to feel the sense of what it was like to be taken care of as a child. That time that they were fed was one of the few times where they felt a reliable presence of the other. And so they downregulate the affects associated with loneliness by consuming food. Or they might go on Amazon and shop. Or they might turn on Netflix for the feeling that other people are in their life. Or they might reach for the alcohol and essentially numb the subcortical information that is associated with loneliness in their body. as well as slamming their brain with GABA so that they have an anxiolytic reduction of anxiety. All of these behaviors have in common that they are not reaching out to another human being and saying, I'm lonely, what are you doing? Picking up the phone. They are seeking an end run around that very basic human need to connect. Interestingly, in the core teachings of the Buddha, this is called craving, tanha. And in the Buddha's teaching, he says that if we don't have the fundamental requisite of metta, which is secure, reliable people that we can talk to, then we go down this path of we have a negative feeling, dukkha vedana. It creates craving for something to get rid of the dukkha vedana. And that craving will lead us towards something that we have developed an addiction to. Very often he says it'll be sensual pleasures, or it will be ritual behaviors that create a sense of security, or it'll be getting lost in the stories of unfairness and victimization and so forth. So we will seek a substitution for metta. When the Buddha was asked by Ananda, what is the single most, you know, is not wise, stable, reliable friends half of the path? The Buddha said, no, they're the entirety of the path. There's a reason he said that, because if you don't have a secure base, reliable, robust connections, then the end result will always be the same. You will always look for a way to auto-regulate your affects, your emotions, your feelings, and that never works. If you look at the work of Cacioppo, the great clinical psychologist, the more people disconnect emotionally from others, the greater the personality disorders, the greater the dysregulation, the greater the chronic stress, and over time, the lifespan goes down rapidly the more people feel what's called emotionally isolated. Emotionally isolated is not the sense that you're absolutely alone, it's the sense that you don't have somebody you can rely on. And to the degree that people feel emotionally isolated is the degree to which their lifespan goes down on average 7 years. That's a significant amount. So, where the hell am I? I've just been rattling this stuff off the top of my head. I haven't been following anything. So, all these attachment wounds happen before memory. So, the idea that you can go into therapy works, but talk therapy that's based on interpreting, like, I get it, I'm an alcoholic because my father was emotionally remote and unreliable, that won't in any way obviate the addictive behaviors. Simply having a left brain understanding does not reach the emotional wounds which were stored in the right hemisphere, which is largely sealed off from our consciousness by the time we're adults. These early learnings about what to expect from other human beings, whether other people are safe, whether they're reliable, whether you can trust them to share about how you're feeling, what you expect from what you'll get in the world. By the age of 2, you have developed very strong, deeply ingrained beliefs, and changing those beliefs so that you will be capable of reaching out and volunteering and disclosing your states is a difficult task. It cannot be done by simply telling you, well, you know, I get it, your childhood had challenges to it, but now there's lots of safe people in this room, just reach out to somebody and share. What the Alan Shore, great neuropsychologist, calls the attachment structures in your right orbital frontal will, when you try to share what's going on, will create physiological tension, aversion, your heart will start to race, it will become very, very difficult for you to disclose how you're feeling, because all of the most prominent events of your life that structured your right brain told you people are not safe. They will abandon you. They will shame you. They will disappear. They will not be around. So to repair damaged attachment structures, to remap them, the process is not intellectual or based on any kind of cognitive understanding. How do we do that? Well, there are a number of ways. One, of course, by far and away the most well-known, is you go to a 12-step group for whatever compulsion or whatever addiction you have. And in going there, you sit in the back and you judge everyone. And you keep your hands crossed in front of your chest and you first believe, oh, these people are... Because if you have insecure attachment, which has led to an addiction or a compulsion, you deep down inside believe that nobody will understand because you didn't get the qualities of being seen, soothed, and appreciated. So you will feel very much alone at first, unique. But then over time, you keep going to those meetings and you'll start to hear people share feelings and experiences that sound uncannily similar to your own. This is my story, so I'm using you, but I mean me as well. And very often people in 12-step groups will use God as an attachment figure. God is a psychological construct that people visualize to create a sense that there is a caring figure in their life. And so they are developing an adult life, a sense of object constancy. I was born an atheistic Jew. When I was 6 years old, I got in trouble in first grade for lecturing the other children on the non-existence of God. So I am not a candidate for that. But as we will talk about, there are in Buddhist practices some guided visualizations that actually can create object constancy, and we're going to be practicing them in a moment so that we can start to address those damaged attachment models, internal working models. When we do these visualizations, we'll be using some of the qualities of what are known as the Brahma Viharas. I hope some of you know what that is, that are the divine attributes or heavenly abodes. Essentially, there are four. And as I list them, keep in mind the four core qualities of attachment, which are once again feeling safe, feeling seen, feeling soothed, and feeling appreciated. So what are the four qualities of the Brahma Viharas? The first is metta, which is an unconditional welcoming of our experience and the experience of others. It is a non-judgmental openness and very aligned with the feeling of being safe that a child needs, a parent that is open, available, present, doesn't reject it or judge it. The second is karuna, compassion for suffering. And that, I would propose, is very similar to being soothed, the quality that a caregiver will soothe us, will stay with us while we're in distress, will not go away, will be a presence that will down-regulate our sympathetic nervous system back to rest and digest. Mudita, appreciation. The sense that even if somebody has attained something that we want, we don't feel threatened, we feel good for them. That is a very similar quality to the need to feel appreciated. by a parent that can stop and can see and delight in our developmental milestones, that can see and spot our efforts and will not feel threatened or feel eclipsed by us. The final quality in the Brahma Viharas is upekkha, balance. And in recent attachment studies by Peter Fanaghi, a great clinical psychologist, shows that another key attribute of the caregiver that a child needs, in addition to the being safe, seen, secure, and appreciative, is a parent that can show us that they are balanced, that they are not too swayed by our emotions, that even though they can mirror to a degree our sadness, our fear, our distress, the parent can also smile and say, I'm okay, I get it, you're upset, but your emotions are not taking over my life. I can, like a good therapist, I can be there, I can empathize, but I am not gonna get pulled out of the rowboat into the ocean. I'll stay in the rowboat and help you slowly get in. So we need a caregiver that is essentially emotionally balanced. And that is very similar to upekkha, which internally is the sense that I can greet everything, I can greet other people, I can see when they're in distress and have compassion for them, I can appreciate good news and accomplishments. But whatever they express, I will not be pulled out of balance. I know what my limits are. I know how much to empathize. I'm not going to be essentially dysregulated. So we're going to be using those. The practice we're going to be doing in early Buddhism is known as Devanusati, which is the visualization of a reliable, caring, often angelic figure, imaginary figure. This was one of the Buddha's 10 recollections that he urged people to practice on a daily basis. In contemporary attachment theory, it's known as the ideal parent protocol, which doesn't quite have the same ring. So we'll do a version of both. The ideal parent is we go back to a time in early life where we felt most alone in the world, and we visualize who would have been the perfect caregiver for us. And so what we are starting to do is develop an object constancy or a felt sense of being witnessed, being seen, being important to another being. And then we'll switch over to the Buddhist practice of Devanusati. And we're going to imbue this parent figure, this deva, with all of the qualities of the Brahma Viharas. They're going to be filled with metta, unconditional welcoming. They are going to be compassionate. They are going to be appreciative, but they will not be pulled out of balance by whatever we're experiencing. So thank you for listening. Now I'm... What? Oh, you give them a bathroom break. You want a bathroom break? People need... Okay, you have a bathroom break, and then we'll start in a half an hour. I mean, 5 minutes.